Fables.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up, candidates backed by President Trump had victories in primary elections around the country yesterday. The Republican Party was once the party of free trade, opposition to high federal deficits, and hawkish toward nations like North Korea. But under President Trump, a lot of that has changed. Traditional Republicans are scarce now among elected officials. What caused the rise of Donald Trump, who has clearly broken with some long-held Republican principles? We're going to talk about that in a moment. Last Wednesday, we ended the fund drive, though, and we came up a bit short, so we are making the money up as we go. And this morning, two more people have contributed, thanks to James, who made a $120 contribution and loves all of WMNF. James is in Tampa. And we had another donation of $1,000 from Kevin. Kevin, thanks a lot, up in Fernandina Beach. Those help a lot. I think we're about $6,000 away from ending the fund drive, and it's real low-key right now. But if you love WMNF, please right now go to our tip jar and make a contribution. You can find it at WMNF.org online. That's WMNF.org. But your contributions keep us independent. And that's how we're on the air, because of contributions from tens of thousands of people in the past 39 years. Well, first, one listener comment about yesterday's discussion about the summit meeting between President Trump and North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un. Here's what one listener had to say.
I'd like to make a comment about this afternoon's Radioactivity. I just want to say that I agree with most people that Kim is not going to give up his guns. You know, he won't get rid of any nuclear weapons, or maybe just a few for show. But I think that it is still very significant, because for the first time in history, the United States president has recognized and praised one of the world's bloodiest dictators.
Well, that's a listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. There's a fierce debate in this country right now about why Donald Trump narrowly won the 2016 presidential election. He was able to break through in traditionally Democratic-leaning states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Here in Florida, which is considered a purple state, Trump won by 113,000 votes, a little bit more than 1% over Hillary Clinton. Our guest, John Campbell, is a professor of sociology at Dartmouth College, and he's written a new book called American Discontent, The Rise of Donald Trump and the Decline of the Golden Age, in which he argues that Trump's victory was long in the making, the result of trends that have been happening here in the U.S. since the 1970s. John Campbell, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thanks for being.
So I want to ask you, you don't think that it was Russian interference or the clever use of Facebook or Russia funding the NRA and giving money to help Trump's campaign? You don't think it was any of these things that helped Donald Trump win the election? You think it was larger forces that have been at work for years?
That's not entirely correct. I don't discount all that Proximus stuff that you just mentioned and more. But I think that that stuff only really was able to come into play because of these long trends that I talk about in the book.
What are the long-term trends that you look at in the book?
So there's basically four. In a sense, as Bill Clinton said, it's the economy, stupid. It starts there. Back in the 1970s, when we had the stagflation crisis, high unemployment, high rates of inflation created lots of problems for middle and working class families, which led them to take on more and more debt to maintain a standard of living that they had become accustomed to and that their parents had become accustomed to. Upward mobility started to get stifled. Unions declined. There were a lot of economic problems. That's the first trend. Second one is trend in race relations. You know, there's the so-called Southern strategy that the Republicans pioneered and perfected, dog whistle politics, as it's sometimes called, where they would blame various economic problems on quote-unquote other people, by which they typically meant African-Americans, and more recently, Mexican immigrants. So there was a racial component to this, which developed over time. There was there was an ideological component, a general shift to the right in a more conservative direction, particularly in terms of economic policy, but also social policy. And then fourthly, increasing political polarization. Those are the four main trends which have been percolating through American politics really since the 1970s. And I think had that not happened, it wouldn't have set the stage for all the stuff that you just mentioned, the Comey letter, Russian interference, and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. So these things that are the long-term trends that have been going on for decades, what set these things in motion? Like when you talk about ideology or the increased political polarization, what caused that?
These are complicated questions. In a nutshell, you could sort of trace this all back to increased globalization and the decline of what I call in the book America's Golden Age, the 50s and the 60s, where we were the big dog on the block. American companies were world leaders in just about everything. But in the late 1960s and 1970s, we started to get challenged. You started to see Volkswagen Beetles on the streets. You started to buy Japanese television sets and so on and so forth. So there was this crunch, an economic crunch that the Americans faced. And when stagflation hit, this was a real problem because up until that time, conventional economics and the view of policymakers was that there's an inverse relationship between unemployment and inflation. As the one goes up, the other goes down. But in the 70s, they were both rising at the same time. This threw conventional economics into chaos. The economists tried to figure out what was going on. There were a lot of solutions on offer. And the one that won was what I would call neoliberalism, which is a conservative solution, which basically says the problem here and the solution, cut taxes, cut regulation, cut government spending. And as more and more people bought into that, you started to see this rightward drift in ideology in the United States, which has been driving politics to a large extent ever since.
Now, some people point to things like the Powell memo in the early 1970s as kind of a wake-up call to conservatives and business interests and corporate interests to get your act together. And that was the beginning of the turnaround, where in the 1960s and 1950s, that so-called golden age, there was kind of like a liberal progressive majority that got civil rights passed and got Medicare passed and all sorts of progressive social programs.
Right.
Yeah.
But you have to remember that there was a dark side to the golden age as well. Despite everything that you said, the African-American community still struggled to catch up, still hasn't caught up in terms of median income, average educational attainment, higher poverty rates in the African-American community than in the white community and so forth. So, when Trump talked about during the election, we need to make America great again, you had to wonder, well, what does he mean again? What did that great America really look like? Was it just for white folks? Was it for everybody? So a little bit of nuance was required there that he basically ignored during the election.
Do you think that he was appealing to racism with that?
Yeah, I do. You know, there was this history, as I said before, the so-called Southern strategy, dog whistle politics, as it's sometimes called, where appeals were made to Southern white working class voters by the Republicans to try and win their votes. And the appeal was that, for example, your taxes are going up. Why is that? Well, because the government needs that revenue in order to pay for social programs. Who gets the benefit of those social programs? It's, quote unquote, those other people. And so it was that sort of an appeal which had been developed by Barry Goldwater. Richard Nixon really sort of took it into an art form at a new level. Somewhat subtle, but Trump arrives on the scene and he basically threw the dog whistle out the window, slamming Mexican immigrants for bringing crime and drugs and all kinds of bad stuff to the United States. accusing Muslims of being terrorists, accusing African Americans of being the blight of inner city America, and so forth. So he was quite overt in terms of these things.
We're talking with John Campbell. His book is American Discontent, The Rise of Donald Trump and the Decline of the Golden Age. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. But I'm still wondering whether or not, did the Democrats just cede this to the Republicans? Because you talk about the problems of debt piling up in families and the decline of upward mobility for all Americans, that the next generation likely will not be as wealthy as the previous generation. So did the Democrats just cede this and say, okay, we're no longer going to be the economic champions of the working class and the middle class?
Well, it depends which Democrats you're talking about, right? Bernie Sanders certainly did not lose that message. That was the core of his campaign, you know, strong, traditional populist kind of an argument. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, seemed to have lost touch with that to a certain extent. And to a degree, that showed up in her campaign in the sense that as the campaign developed, her headquarters in New York City started to get calls from Iowa, from Michigan, from Wisconsin, from people on the ground that said, you know, we're in trouble out here. You're beginning to lose the white working class voter, the traditional Democratic voter. You need to do something about this. Headquarters never really responded by sending more resources or changing strategy. So to an extent, the Clinton campaign missed that boat, I think, a little bit. Bernie Sanders did not.
Why do you think it missed that boat, though? You know, what are the dynamics in the Democratic Party, especially at, you know, the kind of like the controlling faction in the Democratic Party, the Clinton wing? What are the dynamics that would make them give up on the white working class?
Well, it's not so much that they gave up on the white working class, but I think that they were driven by the data analytics in this particular campaign. They had hired folks to run some very sophisticated algorithms based on census data and census tract, which they used heavily, as I understand it, to guide political strategy during the campaign, which is fine up to a point, but that point is where you have foot soldiers on the ground out in the various states and the counties within the states. And they, as I understand it, were sort of shut out from strategic decision-making at headquarters. And so there was less of a balanced approach to formulating campaign strategy than there probably should have been. And I think that that probably hurt the Clinton campaign, too.
There's all this talk about the new America, that America is increasingly turning browner, and it's getting younger, and that the old reliable Republican voters are in the decline, yet Trump just ignored that and went kind of old school when he
right.
was running.
Yeah. No, this is true. And, you know, the Democrats have demography on their side, but it's going to take a while before the numbers finally tilt so that, you know, white Americans are a minority in the country. Trump didn't seem to pay much attention to that, right? And he did a great job at alienating the African-American community. I think it was something like 88 or 90% of the black vote went for Hillary. What was a little bit surprising to me was that only about two-thirds of the Latin Latino vote went to Hillary. Surprising to me because of some of the things that he said on the campaign trail in Phoenix, for example, on a campaign rally. He just came out and blasted Mexican immigrants for being, you know, it's the famous line about being rapists and drug dealers and so on and so forth. Yet he's still able to garner about a third of the Latino vote, which I don't really have an explanation for that.
Well, you cite statistics, you cite the CNN presidential exit poll results, and one of the numbers that just kind of leaps out there, that the question was offered to people who had voted that day in November of 2016, and the question was, illegal immigrants working in the U.S. should either be offered legal status or deported to their home country, and you right. say the CNN exit poll said 84% of Trump voters said that illegal immigrants should be deported to their home country. That's a huge number, 84%.
It is a huge number, and I think that speaks volumes about what you raised before, you know, the ability of the Trump campaign to play the race card. They did so very, very effectively, and that shows up in those numbers. You know, the other interesting thing about these CNN exit polls, I think, is the issue of class. A lot of people say that, what turned this election was the white working class voter going for Trump. In fact, if you look at the numbers in terms of people voting who had incomes above and below $50,000 a year, family income, there's not that much difference in terms of who went for Trump and who went for Hillary Clinton. The big difference, however, are among people who said that life for the next generation of Americans will be better or worse than today. And there are a lot more people that were pessimistic about the future went for Trump. So this gets to that issue of class mobility. People who thought that the life chances for their kids were worse today than they were for themselves overwhelmingly went for Trump. And I think that's the key thing here, not so much the issue of class, which a lot of people like to talk about.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because for the last 20 or 30 years, I've been reading books by liberal and progressive writers like Barbara Ehrenreich and Jacob Hacker and others who are pointing out that this is a big problem that's got to be addressed. It's the liberals and progressives who've been writing about this for decades.
Yeah. The mobility issue. And why the Clinton campaign missed that is... it's something that the Democrats have to grapple with going into the midterms, for sure, and the next presidential election.
We're talking with John Campbell. The book is American Discontent, The Rise of Donald Trump and the Decline of the Golden Age. John, could you just, there's a profile of the typical Trump voter that's on page 144 of your book. Could you read that profile? It's at the bottom of the page?
Sure. It's a little bit long here, but it says that Trump support during the campaign covered a wide range of income and demographic types, but those most likely to support his campaign were people with less than high school education, reporting ancestry as simply American, living in a mobile home, working in old economy jobs like agriculture, construction, manufacturing, and trade, having a history of voting for segregationists, being unemployed, being born in the United States, being an evangelical Christian, having a history of voting for liberal Republicans, and being a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
Who came up with that description?
It's an article by Irwin and Katz from 2016. It's based on survey data before the election. So we need to make a distinction between what people were saying before the election and what people said during the exit polls, which is what I report in the book, the CNN exit polls.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of a discrepancy what people were telling the pollsters in the run-up to the election vis-a-vis what they actually told them coming out of the voting booths.
And again, to your point that the white working class slightly supported Clinton over Trump, it was people at a little bit higher income level that supported Trump for the most part.
I'd have to review the numbers on this, but I think it might be the other way around.
Okay, well, no, correct me, because I might have misunderstood.
But it was not a big difference one way or the other. That's the important point here, I think.
Yeah. All right, so you've got these four trends that you pointed out. So what you're suggesting, I think, is that Trumpism survives Donald Trump, that it's not just like a temporary blip on the political chart of the U.S.
Well, that remains to be seen. I guess the main takeaway that I would suggest from the book is that it didn't necessarily have to be Donald Trump to be in a position to do the sorts of things that he's doing. Trends were in motion so that somebody like Donald Trump would have had a good shot at the presidency. Trump managed to, capture the White House. He did have certain clear advantages over the field of Republicans, which was a pretty broad field in the early days of the primary. One of the things he is great at is capturing sound bites, and I'm sure this is because he's been a media presence for a long time. He knows how to play the media. So he had some great catchphrases, make America great, build the wall, all that stuff. So he was a master at framing message in very, very effective terms. But the message wouldn't have resonated had it not been for these long structural trends that I was talking about.
So in terms of globalization, you know, the question of whether or not the U.S. should have trade relationships and low-tariff trade relationships with a lot of different countries, he has overturned Republican orthodoxy from the last 50 or 70 years on that question. So in doing so, has he permanently reshaped Republican ideology, or what's going on?
I think that's what the Republicans are trying to figure out right now. But let's remember one thing. Trump is on again, off again, on again, off again on this trade policy stuff, right? First he wants to impose steel and aluminum tariffs, then he holds off. Then he reimposes steel and aluminum tariffs. So, you know, it's from one day to the next, the inconsistency is, it's quite amazing, I must say. I have to tell you, I was on a plane recently flying back from Europe, and I sat next to a guy whose career State Department. We had a long conversation about all this. And he said one of the things that people in the State Department are very much concerned about now is just trying to maintain the status quo, because they recognize that Trump is so unpredictable, in not just in terms of trade policy, but in terms of all sorts of foreign relations issues, that the career folks in the State Department are just trying to hold the fort, make sure that something really stupid doesn't get done, and hope that maybe things will change down the line.
But is it your...
Kind of an amazing thing for somebody who's career State Department to admit out loud to a total stranger on an airplane.
It is, but is it your sense that people support Trump because he is the hand grenade that blows up the establishment and in an unpredictable way, but people are just tired of the gridlock and they think that exploding things will ease up the gridlock?
Well, for sure, that's part of his appeal. On the other hand, except among hardcore Republicans who still love the guy, if you look at the public opinion polls, among strong, you know, people who have a strong allegiance to the Republican Party, I think the numbers are 85 or 89% still support the guy. But the swing voters in the middle are beginning to cool. There is a bit of buyer's remorse, I think, that's showing up in the polls now. And it will be very interesting to see what happens in the midterms come November, in terms of all this. But certainly in the beginning, Trump being a bomb thrower, politically speaking, very much played to his advantage because, you know, the public opinion polls are clear. People were fed up with Washington, fed up with gridlock, which is another reason why he was able to capitalize on this thing politically.
Well, one of the trends that you talked about is the scapegoating of racial minorities and immigrants. Does that have a long-term future? Do you see a movement coming out of that survives Trump?
That's a great question. Hard to predict the future, but this racial scapegoating around economic issues has been going on for a long time in the United States, many, many decades. So if I was a betting man, I'd have to bet that this is going to continue going forward. The good news, though, along those lines, is that the economy seems to be doing pretty well. Unemployment rates are quite low right now, although that's a little bit deceptive, too, in terms of what kind of jobs those now employed people have been able to get. We'll just have to wait and see whether or not this trend cools or not.
You know, it just seems that for people who are traditional Republicans, Donald Trump has thrown out a lot of that tradition, and then a lot of elected leaders have followed in lockstep. Now, this isn't completely true. I think the tax bill was pretty much mainstream Republican orthodoxy. But in other ways, you know, there was this tremendous distrust of North Korea. And, you know, we've got to gear up and have a strong military response to anything that North Korea does, heightened tension. And Trump goes in there and at least over the last few days appears to want to erase all that fear and paranoia that we had about North Korea. I don't know if it's going to work, but there's that still that, if we could call it the military-industrial complex, they're probably upset at peace breaking out in the Korean Peninsula if that's where we're headed.
That's right. They'll lose money if that's the way the whole thing goes out. No, it's interesting, just over the last week or so, to see the Republican response to some of the things that Trump has said, particularly the tariff thing. 6 months ago, when Trump really started to talk about imposing tariffs on our allies, there was very little noise coming from the Republican leadership on this, or anybody in Congress for that matter. A little bit, Jeff Flake, for example, but not many people. But over the last week or 10 days or so, more Republicans in Congress have been coming out and basically calling out Trump for this, calling out Trump for the behavior that he exhibited in Canada last week. Now, this is me reading the tea leaves, and that might be a bad thing, but here we go anyway. It seems to me that Republicans are beginning to stand up and have a little bit more backbone to say things against the policies that Trump is advocating. Now, I wonder if this is an indication that they feel Trump's support electorally is beginning to slip. And so they're beginning to hedge their bets a bit in the other direction in the run-up to the midterms. We'll just have to see about that. But it's a hunch that I've been thinking about lately.
All right, so you got essentially the Trump wing of the Republican Party and the traditional conservative wing of the Republican Party that still believes
right.
in free trade. And the same thing on the Democratic side. You've got the
right.
the Hillary Clinton wing, and you've got the Bernie Sanders wing that address some of these trends that you write about in your book, American Discontent. What happens to the parties, do you think?
Well, I think the parties are both in a little bit of trouble right now, trying to figure out what their identities are. The problem here is that the traditional left-right dimension in American politics, conservative, liberal dimension, has now become complicated by the arrival and institutionalization of a second dimension that cuts right through that left-right continuum, and that's a pro- and anti-globalization dimension. So you've got anti-globalization people on both the left and the right, particularly on the trade issue. So Bernie Sanders had real problems with NAFTA. Donald Trump had real problems with NAFTA. But then you've also got people both on the left and on the right that have a much stronger pro-globalization focus. Hillary Clinton, for example, was much more pro-globalization. The libertarians in the Republican Party on the right had a much more pro-globalization view. So in a sense, you've got these two dimensions that intersect, and solving that intersection, how to manage that intersection politically, I think, is the trick that both the Republicans and the Democrats have to figure out. And the party that can solve that first, I think, is going to be in the driver's seat politically.
One last question. Trump did win by only a tiny fraction. And if things had gone differently, a few thousand votes in Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, things might have been differently. Hillary Clinton won the overall vote. So is this really a trend, or did Donald Trump get lucky?
Again, I have to go back to my own argument in defense of myself a little bit here, and which is to say, why was the election so close to begin with? I think it was because the Democrats ignored these trends that I talked about at their own peril, whereas Trump didn't. I do believe that had the Democrats paid more attention to the ideological, the racial, the economic, and the political trends that I talk about in the book, that she would have won in a landslide. I really do believe that.
Mm. John, is there anything else you'd like to point out about your book, American Discontent?
No, I think that pretty much wraps it up. It's as an academic, it was a different and a fun book to write, because I tried not to write an academic book. I tried, forget the theory, forget the big intellectual debates. I just wanted to write a book in part for myself to figure out as best I could what had happened that brought Trump to the White House, and hope that other people find it useful.
Well, John Campbell, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
Rob, it was a pleasure, and thanks very much.
Well, that was an interview I did yesterday with John Campbell, who's a professor in the Department of Sociology at Dartmouth College, and his new book is called American Discontent, The Rise of Donald Trump and the Decline of the Golden Age. It's published by Oxford University Press. Well, we can talk about this, so we're going to open up the phone lines now here on WMNF. Our phone number is 813-239-9663, and you can also email your comments into the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org. John is not here to talk about his book, unfortunately, but if you want to talk about some of the issues that were raised, I see a bunch of emails have come in that want to comment about the contents of that interview. I'm going to suggest a few other news stories that we could talk about, and I'll just read a few of them. Russia is welcoming the outcome of yesterday's summit meeting between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. A Kremlin spokesperson says one can only welcome the fact that such a meeting took place and that direct dialogue was begun. And critics, though, are saying that the pledge between President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un does not include specifics on denuclearization, and there's no mention of human rights in the one-page document that was signed yesterday between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. White House officials defend the summit meeting, saying that the Iran nuclear deal signed by President Barack Obama was imperfect, and it took 18 months of negotiations to arrive at that. It was just months ago when President Trump used his first State of the Union address to condemn the cruelty of North Korea's government, but after his historic summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, whom he described as very smart and having a great personality, Trump seemed to play down the severity of North Korea's human rights violations. Human Rights Watch says North Koreans continue to be subjected to public executions while three generations of a family are punished when one member offends Kim's leadership or the political system. A second incumbent Republican congressman has lost his seat in a primary featuring intense divisions among the GOP in the Trump era. The congressman is Mark Sanford, and he was defeated by Representative Katie Arrington in South Carolina in that congressional primary. She had the backing of President Trump. Sanford branded himself a never-Trumper. Four other states held primaries yesterday in Virginia. Republican known for his defense of Confederate statues, Corey Stewart, won the Republican primary to face Democrat Senator Tim Kaine. A Saudi-led coalition backing Yemen's exiled government began an assault this morning on Yemen's port city of Hodeidah, a crucial battle in the three-year-old conflict. The U.S. is involved in that conflict. It's arming Saudi Arabia. Iranian-aligned Shiite rebels known as Houthis and their allies for years have held on to the Red Sea port of Hodeidah. It's crucial to food supplies for the nation, but it looks like the crisis in Yemen is going to continue. There's a famine in Yemen. More than 10,000 people have been killed in Yemen's civil war. More than 2 million people have been displaced, and there's a cholera epidemic. And the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition has been criticized for airstrikes killing civilians. The American Medical Association is pressing for a ban on assault weapons. This after their meeting yesterday in Chicago. South Florida billionaire Jeff Green says he's willing to spend whatever it takes to become the next governor of Florida, as much as $200 million, maybe. We could talk about these and some other issues. We could talk about Comcast. There's so many other issues out there, too. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And Jeff Haynes is among our phone producers today. We're going to go to Russell in Tampa, who's been holding for a while. Russell, thanks for calling in. What would you like to comment about?
Hi, Rob. You mentioned your guest is gone. I just had a question.
Yeah, sorry about
for
that.
The guest.
Yeah.
No, no problem. I probably have the same question for him that I have for any political scientist, which is, Trump was the culmination of things. The Democrats had lost 1,000 seats nationwide for 8 years running. So I get it that people want to put this Trump thing out there as the flashpoint for all this. It's been going on for 10 years.
Well, I think that's what his point was. He said that the trends have been going on for 10 years and the Democrats didn't address the trends, weren't aware of them, but Trump was the culmination of, Campbell says four or five major trends. I could reread them for you, too. But he says it's not a surprise. He says it's a trend that's been going on for years, and the Democrats didn't really notice the trends.
Right, right. And the other thing that is noticeable to me, I'm a conservative. You know, you've talked to me before. I find some of Trump's behavior abhorrent, but I think he's a change agent that was needed. But, you know,
Do you like the analogy that he's the grenade that you throw in to blow up the gridlock?
Yeah, I do. I think the status quo was not a good place to be. We may have swung too far away from it here. We'll see. But I think shaking things up was what the country wanted, and that's what we're getting. You know, and you may like it or you may not like it, but like anybody in government should be concerned, because basically he's putting in a stress test, they call this in the business world, where you literally look at and examine every little thing and go, how are they doing? Do we need it? Does it need to change? And I think that's what Trump's trying to do to the United States government, and it's freaking people out.
Yeah, I know. I've got a lot of friends who are freaked out. All right, Russell, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks. 813-239-9663. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. This is a live call-in show, and a lot of people want to respond to the interview with John Campbell. I'm going to read some of the emails that have come in just a moment. Let's go to Robert in Town and Country. Robert, you're on WMNF. Hey, what would you like to say?
Good afternoon, Rob. I listened to the interview with the gentleman, and I'll tell you, it just lets you know why the Democrats have lost touch. I mean, all the things I heard when they gave a list of the, you know, traits of a Trump voter, I knew I was going to hear all those things. And that's simply, you know, I might be more educated than the person who wrote that article, but, you know, there's no guarantee of that. But
what's your education, Robert?
Well, I did go to an Ivy League school, but never mind.
Where'd you attend?
That's a long story. Yeah. I chose not to even do anything really with that. I did use it, education to a point, but I went to a whole other field out of love of doing something. I went to Yale. That's it. And that's, I guess today that would be very liberal there. It was a little bit.
And what was your degree?
Oh, I didn't finish. I went for 2 years.
Okay.
I played baseball there.
All right.
Anyways, you can't just go play baseball there. You have to have some kind of education. But anyways, I've had other technical stuff and things. But anyways, here's my point is that, you know, I heard even on a show the other day how all Trump voters are racist. Another thing, every time I hear that, my wife has since passed away. 7 years this month, but I was married to a black woman, so I'm not prejudiced, but and then whenever I hear that, I say God.
Well, it may not apply to you, but do you think
right.
Robert, I don't know, did you go to many Trump rallies? I went to three Trump rallies here in Tampa, and finding a black person in a Trump rally in Tampa was a rare thing. I can guarantee you that.
The people there are racist. It just means that they've sold, the black community that Trump is against them. But anyways, that's not my point. My point is they come up with all these reasons, whether it was the Russian, all the reasons of why, and Hillary, let me tell you, anybody I know that wanted to vote for Hillary, and I know a lot of people, there were some people who had better reasons, but I heard a lot of, like, the first woman. I didn't hear, but I kept asking and listening to debates and listening to her on the news, and I didn't hear anything about issues, nothing concrete. I think he resonated with people, and I do believe in the hand grenade. If anything, it'll change politics as we know it, where politicians are going to, I want them to be successful because I want politicians to realize you can't just be, politically correct. You have to, do what you say what you do, all that stuff, this gridlock and all this, nothing. And
all right, Robert, I don't want you to have the whole show, because I've got every line lit, and I've got about 10 emails that I haven't read,
but
so if you don't mind, I'm going to move on. Is that okay?
With the people.
They're all right,
connect with people, and they don't, and they're still not.
All right, Robert, thanks a lot. Thanks for that email. or for that phone call. 813-239-9663. Mike wants us to mention that Michael Cohen is flipping. There have been reports for the last 24 hours that the president's personal attorney has told his friends that he might be arrested and that his current attorneys have left him. That's those are some of the reports that are out there. We don't know whether or not Michael Cohen has flipped. If that happens, we will have it on the NPR News. We will have it on the WMNF News. And I've got my phone in front of me, so I get the news flashes as they come in. So if I see it on one of my news flashes, I will report it to you as soon as that comes in. But so far, no confirmation. Ernie writes this: the Democratic Party has been the party of the educated professional class for several decades, writes Ernie in Port Richey. That's his view. Let's go to Gary in Dunedin. Gary, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob, in my ongoing personal experiment, by talking to people that I see in public places who are self-identifying as Trump supporters by bumper stickers, MAGA hats, T-shirts, and sometimes even inadvertently, I think that your guest had some things right, but some things wrong. First of all, it's a progressive versus a conservative, and how should I say it, selfish and narrow point of view. The people that support Trump are primarily concerned with several things. First of all, they hate the Democrats. They hate Hillary. They hate the political establishment of, quote, liberals. Second, many of them are the so-called born-agains who want to make women into gestation slaves so that they can't terminate abortions. Third, they back U.S. militarism, U.S. nationalism, and the U.S. as the best country in the world. Fourth, they love guns. Fifth, they view most minorities and poor people as losers and takers. Sixth, they don't share any of the progressive values, such as a concern for non-human animals and the environment. They could care less about the environment as long as it's jobs, jobs, jobs. Go ahead and pollute the air, rape the oceans and the land. Who cares? They don't have a social justice orientation. They don't have an others' welfare orientation. They're primarily very consumer capitalist. They like toys, like boats and stuff like that. They're me first, my family first, my money first. And that's the difference between a progressive and a Trump supporter. It's also true that the Trump reached into their heads viscerally and using high-level marketing techniques, and that the Democrats, even to this day, Schumer and Pelosi especially, are clueless about messaging. Bernie is really our only hope. I wouldn't say that Trump supporters are racist, but they do share the Rush Limbaugh-type view of minorities. So that's maybe some generalizations, but they're based on real-world experiences. I've been talking to many Trump supporters. I'm a chameleon, so they don't know what I think. And we need to recognize that Trump is going to win again unless the Democrats put up Bernie and a suitable vice presidential candidate and do a lot better messaging in 2020.
All right, Gary, thanks a lot.
Thanks
for
brother.
Your phone calls and your accounts of the people that you talk to. Carmen writes this. Carmen writes regarding racism, "Make America Great Again" is a racist slogan? Question mark. Do you know that Clinton and Reagan used it for their campaigns too? That's the problem with the modern liberal who attributes everything to racism. People are rejecting identity politics and know that when the economy improves, that it's good for everyone, no matter what color you are, writes Carmen. And then somebody from the 813 area code, or the 727 area code rather, says, please read the trends again. These are the four or five trends that my guest John Campbell writes about in his book. And I'm not going to read them all, but I'll just try to give you a quick thumbnail very quickly. He says the four trends that contributed to Trump's win were the onset of stagflation, automation, globalization, and increased international competition. The scapegoating of racial minorities and immigrants as the false cause of declining opportunity and income and growing inequality that Trump used to win white, middle, and working class voters. The rise and spread of neoliberal, meaning conservative or small government and free market ideology, which Trump mined to promote his anti-establishment position. Sharpening partisan, racial, cultural, and ideological polarization between the Republican and the Democratic parties, which guaranteed that the Republican voters would support Trump no matter what he did. And spilling over of partisan polarization into crippling political and policy gridlock after the 2008 financial crisis, the election of the nation's first black president, Barack Obama, the passage of Obama's signature health insurance reform, and the rise of the Tea Party. These are the trends that Campbell said resulted in the election of Donald Trump. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Thanks for tuning in. Glad you're there. Just remember that we are a listener-supported radio station, and we're unique in this area. Please, if you haven't yet made a contribution to WMNF, please go to our website and make a contribution. We came up a little bit short during our seven-day fund drive last week. You can go to WMNF.org. It's a secure website, and make a contribution to this show or any other show on WMNF. Let us know what your favorite show is. We're going to go back to the phones, and let's go to the person who's been holding the longest. That's Dan in Tampa. Hi, Dan. You're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob, I'm shocked it took that guy to get through 2 years of Yale Law School. But anyway.
He didn't finish Yale. He was an undergrad.
I know. It's a joke. Yeah. Yale makes locks, you know what I mean?
Oh, I got you. Yale Law School. Okay, now I get it. Didn't get it the first time.
All right. But, you know, that guest you had on, Rob, they often talk about the competition, and they always refer to the 50s, 60s, and even when he said, you know, late 60s.
That's what he said, the golden age of America was.
Right, yeah. But they leave out the most major part of the golden age, Rob. Who was our competition, Rob? Where was the rest of the world at in 1950, per se? They were still bombed the hell out.
Yeah, well, but still, America was the number one economic power on the globe for those years, and that's when the middle class was the strongest in the U.S.
It was killing it. You're right, Rob, and we were killing it. And then come along the later part of the 60s, well, Germany kind of had rebuilt a little bit by that time. So did Asia and Japan. You start seeing Toyotas. Damn, they started making televisions. We just kicked back and didn't do too much about it because we were living the good life. And now we're complaining because we have competition. No. I don't, you know, it's kind of like the Canadians right now. How are they looking upon us? This guy's telling them that the reason he put a tariff on their steel and aluminum is because of security reasons, because we don't have the high-grade aluminum for, airplanes to be made here too much. And what is he trying to say, that Canada would stop giving it to us and selling it to us? This is ridiculous. We have a surplus trade with Canada. We take in more of their money than we, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Our tariffs are higher than Canada's tariffs, too.
Our tariffs are far higher. Yeah. Us and the EU have the highest tariffs in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, it was surprising the president was complaining about Canada, because when it comes to trade, we have it pretty good with Canada. We have a trade surplus with Canada.
And they talk about milk and cheese, Rob. I just want to remind people in this country, milk and cheese, that the trade with Canada is less than 0.1% of milk and cheese.
All right, okay? Dan, thanks
a lot.
One other
thing, real quick, about milk and cheese. The U.S. government has had to go and purchase $40 million worth of cheese, it seems like, every other year, from these dairy farmers who keep increasing their volumes and forcing the government to pay them money. That's what's happening. They buy 40 and then they give it away to other countries. Yeah, but we, the taxpayers, put that bill and it is increasing. And it's all put into this farm bill stuff.
All right, Dan, thanks a lot.
Yeah. All right.
Dan, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. And let's go to Fred in Clearwater. Hi, Fred. What would you like to say? Fred?
Oh, hi, Rob. Good morning.
Yeah, it sounds like you're in a tunnel, Fred. Are you working underground today?
I got you on speaker, Fred.
Oh, okay. All right. You might take us off because it's going to be a little disconcerting.
Well, I enjoyed your guest there that came on, the author, but when he went to describe Trump voters as living in trailers and not graduating from high school, he failed to realize one thing as well as you is that Trump won 200 counties that were previously Obama counties. Now, are you calling everybody in those 200 counties white trash and uneducated? I think wrong. I think a majority of those people are black and Hispanic, and they've changed their mind, and they've voted for Trump.
You know, I've not seen the numbers on Black and Hispanic. That was kind of that was an average study done by two guys named Irwin, or two people named Irwin and Katz. And I haven't looked at the original study, but this is the average. And I know this hurts a lot of Trump voters, but I'll just read it again. This is what our guest said. Trump support during the campaign covered a wide range of income and demographic types. However, those most likely to support his campaign were people with less than a high school education, reporting ancestry as simply American, living in a mobile home, working in old economy jobs like agriculture, construction, manufacturing, and trade, having a history of voting for segregationists, being unemployed, being born in the U.S., being an evangelical Christian, having a history of voting for liberal Republicans, and being a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. So that is kind of an average. That's not everybody that voted for Trump, and some of those people would have voted for Clinton or Jill Stein.
Hogwash.
Yeah.
That's
so go ahead. You should go and say that's hogwash. Okay, so why do you say that?
That 200 counties that previously went to Democrats went to Republicans. You're going to tell me that in those 200 counties, all those people fall in the categories you're describing?
No, again, I'm saying that's an average. That is just, if you were one of these people, it was likely during the election that you would have voted for Trump. It doesn't define every Trump voter. It's a tool that researchers use to say these are the points at which you might find more Trump voters than you would find Stein or Hillary Clinton voters. It's not to describe every voter. And Fred, I don't know if we're going to get anywhere in this conversation, frankly.
Well, I think your author should have mentioned the 200 counties that previously went to Democrats that now went to Republicans. And to try to say that those people are somehow lesser humans than anyone else is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't think he's saying that the people that are blue collar are lesser humans. I don't think that's the point he was making.
It reveals the bias of you and your station.
Well, just because you disagree with something, you think that we're biased? I mean, I'm interviewing a guy about his book, and this is a guy who studied the outcome of the election in an academic way, and I think people who have studied the election from an academic point of view are interesting, and that's why I invite them on. And you know, last week I had one of the top editors at the National Review on, one of the best conservative publications in the country. So you know,
very good. Yeah.
You know, I think what we've gotten away from is we can have a conversation, right? Yeah, we can talk about things. And I think it's your right to say, hey, I object to the way he described Trump voters. I think that's your right. But I think we've got to listen to each other, too. Can you tell me, Fred, where there's any other station here in the Tampa Bay area that is having an hour-long program with an academic and with you talking about the forces, the trends in American society that resulted in a Trump victory? Can you name any other radio station that in the Tampa Bay area that does this?
No, in fact, I get through on occasion to not just your show, but other shows. I've been known to lose my temper slightly, but I feel that there's a bias in the media. And it's being revealed more and more.
Yeah, but Fred, if I wanted to hear people lauding President Trump and saying only good things about him, 100%, I could turn on six local radio stations today. I could turn on two or three TV networks today, and I could hear all that stuff. I mean, I could turn on the Christian TV station and hear all that stuff. So I think the media is diverse, and here what you get is a more thoughtful, academic, sometimes perspective, not always. But you know, I think M&F serves a purpose, and if we went away, you wouldn't hear a discussion like this on any of the other 53 radio stations. There would be nothing like
right.
it on. Yeah. So Fred, thanks a lot. I want to hear from some more people, but Fred.
I do appreciate all that you do. I love your show.
All right, Fred. Thanks a lot. Thanks for saying this. Let's go to Don in Port Richey, who's been holding the longest. Don, you're on. We only have 30 seconds, unfortunately. Don, take it away.
Thanks for the show. I'll try to be quick. A quick observation. Those people that were talking about Trump throwing a grenade in the gridlock, Which party is responsible for that? It's the Republicans. Look at them right now. They own the House and the Senate and the presidency, and they still can't get anything through because of the Tea Party people. That's where you need to throw the grenade.
Okay.
Going back,
John, I'm so sorry. We're out of time. I'm so sorry. I wish we had more time. Well, all right. So if you want to comment about anything you've heard here for the past hour, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I will be playing your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Now stay tuned for NOLA and the Midpoint program. And thanks to you if you made a contribution last week during our fund drive. We came close. We're within $6,000 of getting all the money we need to stay on the air. Thank you for listening to WMNF in Tampa. I'm Rob Lurie. This